You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
In 2002, Trent Lott, a senior U.S. senator from Mississippi and majority leader in Congress, gave a speech at the 100th birthday party of Strom Thurmond. Thurmond had recently retired after a long political career, which included a 1948 run for president on an openly segregationist platform. In his remarks, Senator Lott praised Thurmond's presidential campaign and said that if the rest of the country had followed Mississippi's lead in voting for him, the U.S. wouldn't have had all the problems it has. 2 weeks after Trent Lott made those remarks, he bowed to public pressure and announced that he wouldn't seek to remain majority leader in Congress. Clay Shirky argues that Trent Lott's withdrawal from public office wouldn't have happened without the widespread use of the Internet. Clay Shirky is the author of the 2008 bestseller, Here Comes Everybody. The book examines the power of organizing without organizations. One of the topics Shirky explores is the changing world of journalism and the media. Lorraine Chisholm spoke with Clay Shirky earlier this week, and she began by asking him why the press didn't cover Trent Lott's remarks.
They were set to cover Trent Lott's birthday party as a kind of swan song for a politician who's served a long time. They weren't looking for real policy issues. They were just looking to cover it as a kind of, you know, human interest story. And it was really the bloggers who picked up on it, who recognized it for what it was, which was actually a remarkable statement of policy from within the Republican Party, not in fact just a birthday party story.
Well, how did the story then grow to the extent that Lott felt compelled to withdraw?
Well, it grew to that extent in a series of small occurrences, none of which would have been possible again without the involvement of a lot of different people. First was that, as I said, the bloggers picked up on this, you know, this praise for a nakedly segregationist platform, and especially among the Republican bloggers, who, of course, the only ones the Bush administration was listening to, there were a number of Republicans for whom the casual racism of the Republican, you know, that section of the Republican Party, was just anathema. Chief among them was Instapundit, a very well-known and well-regarded Republican blogger, who said essentially, this is evil and loony, the fact that Strom Thurmond would be doing this. And because bloggers don't have any concept of the news cycle, at least not as newspapers do, which is to say, today we have to report yesterday's news, tomorrow we can report today's news, the issue stayed fresh. The next thing that happened was a guy named Ed Sebesta, who lives in Texas and collects the kind of subterranean Confederate literature that most Americans don't see, was able to step forward and say, you know what, this isn't the first time Trent Lott has said something like this. In fact, he's been talking this way to the pro-segregationist population for a long time. And then the last thing that happened was Daily Kos, the well-known liberal blogger, picked up Ed Sebesta's stuff and reran it. And every one of those little links kept the story alive long enough for Lott to have to apologize. And, of course, the minute he apologized, the mainstream press could jump back in and cover the apology, at which point they went back and covered the original story. And what looked like it had been safely buried over the course of 10 days suddenly reemerged as a serious political brouhaha.
And was there a period in there where the mainstream media felt that they couldn't really jump in until they had some sort of trigger which said it was newsworthy?
Well, this is exactly what happened. Yes, and that period was starting the day after the birthday party, because they covered the birthday party. One person in the Washington Post essentially said, hey, this is a little weird, this segregationist stuff. But other than that, it passed unnoticed. And the problem with newspapers is the logic of the newspaper is every story needs what newspaper people call a peg, which isn't just why is this important, but why is this important now? And the logic of a peg is if something wasn't important yesterday and nothing happened overnight, then it's also not important today. And so once they didn't cover the initial story, they never had a reason to jump back in and cover it later. They would have been accused of political bias and so forth. And it was only Lott's apology that provided them with a peg that let them jump back on the story and essentially try to make up for the poor coverage before by suddenly piling on. So it went literally from no one covering it to almost every serious national paper covering it in the space of 24 hours once Lott apologized.
Now you say the link between what journalists think is newsworthy and what gets covered has now been broken. How so?
The news used to be whatever was in the news media, right? I mean, it was almost tautological that the medium determined the content of that, you know, of that particular category. Now, if newspapers don't, you know, if newspapers essentially through a series of individualist decisions end up not covering a story, that story can still get covered elsewhere. And so it wasn't that the general populace, or the political class, didn't know that Lott had gone around praising a segregationist. It's just that they didn't know it from newspapers anymore. So the irony is the newspapers didn't make the story. They actually had to cover the story because their readers were getting it from other sources. And so it puts newspapers in a very different position than the one they'd been in previously, which is that the agenda for what constitutes news in any given country is no longer set by what we used to regard as the news media, because if individuals can commit acts of journalism, and to use Ethan Zuckerman's famous phrase, then people outside the news media can actually determine what's news, and the newspapers have to follow suit rather than lead.
Do you think that the host of blogs on the internet that are publishing news that newspapers aren't should be seen as publishing sites in the same way as newspapers are?
Well, I don't think they are publishing sites in the same way that newspapers are, which is to say, none of the apparatus of publishing applies to weblogs. I mean, this is really the major change. It used to be that to be a publisher, you had to have fantastically expensive equipment and a lot of employees, and to incorporate and have contractual relations and all of the trappings that came with the incredible difficulty, complexity, and expense of putting something in the public eye. And now putting something in the public eye is not difficult, it's not complex, and it's not expensive. And so what bloggers are doing is a different kind of thing than what traditional publishers are doing, because none of the legal or organizational trappings that used to be required from publishing are requirements anymore.
I thought it was interesting in your book how you described newspapers as a collection of sort of disparate pieces of information, where sports stories go next to stories on Iraq. And when you look at it in that way, it's almost an illogical collection of stories.
Yeah, no, newspapers make no sense as a form other than the fact that as long as it's all on paper, you might as well put anything in the bundle that the average reader might be interested in. Yeah, but the idea of having the restaurant reviewer work for the same organization as the people who report from Baghdad, there's no internal logic to that. It was just the old economics of paper. So, you know, there's a big conversation, certainly in the States and really all over the English-speaking world, about the fate of newspapers. The problem with newspapers isn't financial bankruptcy, it's organizational bankruptcy. It doesn't make any sense to have that form of organization anymore if you don't also have news produced on paper. And so as we, you know, shift slowly from news produced on paper to news produced online, other organizational forms are starting to come in and you know, essentially take over the publication and dissemination of what we call news.
You compare what's happening now to the years immediately after Johannes Gutenberg's invention of movable type. Why do you think that's a useful analogy?
I think it's a useful analogy because, well, really for a couple of reasons. First is just that in the direct comparison, what movable type did is it vastly lowered the cost and increased the volume of information. And as a result, there was a nearly complete collapse in quality. Before the printing press, if you could get your hand on a book in Europe, it was a priceless book, right? It was either the Bible or it was Aristotle or it was Galen. But the books that had been preserved were almost uniformly important. After the printing printing press, people started publishing junk, right? They were publishing novels and travelogues and so forth, and most of it's unreadable. Most of what was published in the 1500s isn't worth reading. But also, Galileo published in the 1500s. Also, Copernicus published in the 1500s. So you get these sort of gems of quality that couldn't have appeared in any other medium amidst this sea of dreck. And that's what's happening now, right? The cost of publishing has, again, fallen through the floor. The volume of what's being published is exploding, and as happened with the printing press, the average quality of what gets put out in public has collapsed. But you're also starting to get writing and essays and video and audio and photographs, all the rest of it, that couldn't have been produced without the internet. And a little bit at a time, we are grouping our way towards figuring out how to use this new medium in the same way that in the 100 years after the printing press, we figured out how to use that medium.
Now, one of the principles of pre-internet journalism is the idea of journalistic privilege, which you say relies on a scarcity of publishing outlets. That sense that when I say journalistic privilege, for instance, that you can a journalist could keep their sources confidential. What happens when that scarcity ceases to exist?
You know, I don't know. I mean, this is really the paradox of the revolutionary, which is the bigger a deal you think something is, the less successfully you can predict what will happen, because really deep changes affect all kinds of social bargains in quite profound ways. It seems to me that there's no way to preserve journalistic privilege as we've known it, because the people who confer journalistic privilege, the people who offer journalists a safe haven to not reveal their sources, are publishers, right? There is no coherent definition of journalist that's separate from person employed by a publisher. And the only reason there was a small number of publishers is it used to be really expensive to put stuff in public. And as I said, all of that economics is blown up. Now, if anybody can report on activities they observe, which is increasingly the world we live in, we can't offer people who are reporting in public freedom from having to testify in court, because if that covers all citizens, the courts can no longer compel anyone to testify. Right? If my brother-in-law is cheating the IRS and somebody comes and asks me for evidence, and I say, you know, I was just about to blog about that, so I actually can't tell you anything, we suddenly have a loophole that was extended to a small group of people, and we turn it into a loophole for all of society, which we can't stand. On the other hand, we desperately need professional truth-tellers who can offer some kind of deal to potential sources in order to uncover wrongdoing. And I suspect we're going to go from an employment-based test to some kind of importance-based test. But it's not going to be easy, and it's not going to be quick. And I think the law is just going to wander in the wilderness for about 10 years until some precedent gets set that everybody rallies around. But it's never going back in the bottle of, since journalism is a very scarce and rare activity, we can just afford to offer all journalists this get-out-of-jail-free clause, as it were, without having to worry that it'll become too general.
Now, as you mentioned, a lot of people are asking the question, are newspapers going to survive? And I guess the premise that they're attaching to that question is that the publishing of newspapers somehow correlates to high-quality journalism. Do you think that that's an interesting question, whether newspapers survive for the future of quality journalism?
It's an interesting question for the people who work at newspapers, I suppose. Obviously, from everything I've said, I don't think newspapers are going to survive. Not because they're running out of money, but because it doesn't. If your mechanism getting the news out is a web server, doesn't make any sense to have an organization that's formed around the printing press, right? I mean, newspapers are the shape they are because you had to move the workers to the industrial job site. It's exactly the logic of the steam-driven loom from the age of industrialization, right? You have to go get the workers to where the big, heavy equipment is. The real question, I think, is, given that we've used newspapers to support the public good of all kinds of investigative reporting, and quality journalism is, that's just too much of a kind of a namby-pamby judgment call. There's plenty of quality journalism going on in all kinds of media, right? Television, I mean, down in the States, 60 Minutes, one of our famous television shows, does quite incredible work in the television media. what newspapers do genuinely do that almost no other medium does is they do the daily grunt work of covering City Hall and the local courthouse. And I think the real question isn't whether newspapers survive, because the answer over the long haul is no. The real question is, how do we make sure we don't lose local reporting as newspapers are painfully restructured into whatever, you know, whatever the post-newspaper world looks like? And that's I think, a much more interesting question, because saving newspapers, you know, I mean, you could keep them alive for another 5 years with injections of cash or whatever, but that's just newspaper hospice care. What you really want to save is the journalists and the reporting. And I think that the people like ProPublica, like Spot.us, who are trying to find alternate models for getting good reporting, are likelier to be the side of that kind of journalism in the future than the newspapers we have today.
Well, it's been great talking to you this morning, Clay.
Very good. Thanks so much. Nice to talk to you, too.
Thank you.
Clay Shirky is the author of the 2008 bestseller, Here Comes Everybody, and he spoke with Lorraine Chisholm earlier this week.